Hey everybody, welcome to a great edition of Mind Shift Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. I've got a fantastic interview coming up in just a couple of minutes with Rick Allen Ross. He is the author of the book, Cults Inside Out, How People Get In and Can Get Out. And this is something, as you know, if you've been listening to this podcast at all since January, I have been fascinated more and more by the subject of cults. And I reached out to Rick a few months back, and we've been working for a long time to get this interview together. And so we finally made it happen after a couple of fits and starts. But about probably a month before I talked to Rick and we did the actual interview, I actually sent him a list of questions, things that I've been working through in my reading, my research. I read articles by him, as well as looking on his fantastic website, which is culteducation.com. There's a tremendous amount of resources and articles on there if you're researching a particular cult or just want to find out more about how cults or groups with undue influence operate. Maybe you don't have a specific group in mind, but culteducation.com is a fantastic resource for that. But anyway, as I say, I was super excited to talk to Rick because in my list of questions, I had been kind of going through a lot of things in my own mind, and it was my own sort of process of reconstruction as well as the deconstruction piece of it. The more I read, the more I researched about the world of the cults, then I was able to draw that and bring that into the world of evangelicalism or fundamentalist Christianity. I saw the overlaps and the parallels, and of course I did a podcast on this in January, and I also did a podcast which is available right now on Patreon. I think I might be releasing it as well on a podcast at some point here. And what I did was I used Robert J. Lifton's book called Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism. And I go through the psychology of conversion and I frame it in the religious context from where I came from, Christian evangelicalism, Christian fundamentalism. What actually happens to a person when they go through and experience the psychological pressure to convert, to confess his or her sins. And I go through the whole thing all the way through to the end when a person decides maybe they've had enough, they can't live with the cognitive dissonance, and they decide to walk away from the whole thing. They're disoriented, and I go through all that. Now, these are all questions and topics that I had for Rick as well, and so in this episode, I'm going to pepper him with loads of questions, and unfortunately, we didn't get to all of them, but we'll do some more maybe in a future podcast. I'm also going to be talking to another cult expert at some point too, maybe the next couple of months, Stephen Hassan, and I've mentioned him in my episode in January. He's the one that has the BITE model. It's how cults control, or groups with undue influence, how they control and manipulate their members through behavior control, information control, thought control, and emotional control, which is the BITE acronym. And so what's fascinating to me is how cults and groups with undue influences, and of course this can include fundamentalist or evangelical churches also, but what's fascinating to me is there's a fairly small amount of plays in the cult playbook, so to speak. And what I want to really ask Rick in this episode is, how is it that groups are able to do that? Why is this so universal across the world, across the decades, really, going back to not just the cult phenomenon in North America in the 1960s and 70s, but going back over a century to groups like the Watchtower Organization, the Jehovah's Witnesses, founded in the late 19th century, as well as the Mormons, the Latter-day Saints, and all the splinter groups that have come out of that, the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, and all kinds of other very, you know, polygamous groups and all kinds of other groups that have destroyed so many people, and there's sexual abuse and all kinds of horrific things. And so Rick and I are going to get into that in just a minute. I just wanted to say really quickly that there are some fantastic benefits to being a Patreon supporter of Mindshift Podcast. Typically, you'll have early access to shows. They drop on Wednesdays. I'm now doing episodes every other Friday as I've just started a new job in January. So I don't have as much time now to do episodes every week, but I tend to drop these on Wednesdays for Patreon supporters, as well as other content. I'm actually doing a video course online I'm trying to add a video a month as I get time. It's called Reconstruction After Deconstruction. And although I've been focusing a lot on deconstruction from an ex-evangelical point of view, I think now that I've been doing so much research and reading and talking to cult experts like Rick Ross, I think I need to widen that out a little bit and do some episodes from the sort of cult's perspective, the cult's point of view, helping people who've come out of cults, like my guests last week, Stephen Unthank and Laura Caput from Melbourne, Australia. And in fact, one of the cool things about making the connection with specifically Laura is that she's put me on to another woman, Dassie Ehrlich, and I've actually talked to her once. We had a good Facebook chat the other day. She's also from Melbourne, and we're going to hear her story at some point here when she has a little bit of time to actually do this recording. She's very busy, but this is another fascinating story. She's a woman who comes out of a very fundamentalist Jewish sect in Melbourne, Australia, and her story is you couldn't make this stuff up, literally. If you've ever seen that documentary on Netflix called One of Us, then you'll know a little bit about kind of the story of what Dassie is going to bring to the show. So I'm really looking forward to that, as well as, like I say, bringing you an interview with Stephen Hassan, hopefully next month. So let's go on into the chat with Rick Ross. I've got a whole bunch of questions for Rick about how cults operate. So let's talk to the author of Cults Inside Out and explore in further depth the world of the cults and how they operate. I am very happy to be joined in the studio today by Rick Ross, who is a cult expert and an author. I am really interested to talk to you and pick your brains today, Rick. So welcome. Thank you for being a guest on Mindshift Podcast.
Thanks, Clint. I've been interested in cults going back to 1982. And my book, Cults Inside Out, goes into the subject in great depth.
So what was it that led you to start studying the world of the cults? What's your interest? What kind of work are you doing now?
Well, it directly affected my family. My grandmother lived in a nursing home, and a particular group targeted the elderly. And they covertly infiltrated the paid professional staff of the nursing home where my grandmother lived. And they confronted her in a recruitment effort. And I found out about it. And that led me to become a kind of anti-cult activist, community organizer. I was appointed to committees first in Phoenix and then later nationally in New York and Washington, D.C. And my work expanded from being a volunteer to being a staff member at a social service agency and an educational bureau. And by the end of the 80s, I was doing intervention work, helping people to get out of cults for families. And then beginning in the 90s, I started to be a court expert. And I have since been qualified, accepted and testified in 11 states, including federal court. So my work expanded over a course of years, but it began really because it affected my life personally and my family.
You had a personal interest in getting essentially your grandmother from being targeted from a religious group. Well, I'm fascinated by this. I've been doing a lot of research in the last probably 4 or 5 months. I'm an ex-evangelical, so I came out of fundamentalist Christianity, and what struck me was about probably 6 months ago, there was a series of programs here in the UK called Twisted Faith Week, and basically it was a series of documentaries about ex-cult members. They had ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, ex-Mormons, ex-Scientologists, and what struck me as we watched these series of documentaries was how similar the stories were when you boiled it down to kind of the core cult playbooks or cult tactics. And what it struck me was how similar these things were to my own experience coming out of Christian fundamentalism. And what I want to know, I guess, is why is there such a strikingly similar pattern that cults use? There seems to be a fairly small playbook. Can you comment on why this seems to be the case? It's sort of a worldwide phenomenon, isn't it?
It is. It's global. I've done interventions across the world. I've been to Australia, Asia, Europe. I've traveled all over the world doing my work. So it's not just a problem in the U.S., though the U.S. offers very particular protections and exemptions for groups that claim to be religions that achieve nonprofit tax-exempt status. For example, Scientology does not have that status in Germany, but yet they do have that status in the U.S., and it insulates them from accountability, complete financial transparency, and so on. But I would say that the methods that are used by destructive cults are very similar, because whether they read these methods and practice them or just simply reinvent the wheel, the same basic principles of coercive persuasion and the tricks that they can learn from influence techniques, which are widely published and known, can be incorporated to gain undue influence over people. And there are many, many groups that use this. But I think it's important distinctions, because some of the groups that you mentioned, for example, Jehovah's Witnesses or the Mormons or certain fundamentalist Christian organizations, they may be authoritarian, but they may not be destructive cults. And my definition of a destructive cult is very narrow and focused. That is, a group with an absolute totalitarian leader that becomes an object of worship is the defining element and driving force of the group. And number two, that the group uses coercive persuasion to gain undue influence over its members. And then three, if it's a destructive cult, they use that undue influence, the group does, to exploit and do harm to the members. Now, that varies by degree from group to group. So you can have one group that can be very extreme, very abusive. People could even be dying. The group could be violent. And that would be the most extreme version. Or you could have a group where the leader is simply using his or her undue influence to bilk money out of the members of the group, or to make money from them through free labor, etc. So I think it's important to make those distinctions. And having said that, you may see the same coercive persuasion and influence techniques and harm being done by groups that don't have an absolute totalitarian leader, but are authoritarian and are harmful. And I certainly consider Jehovah's Witnesses to fall within that category.
Yes, I've just had two people on the podcast last week from Melbourne, Australia, who are both ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. He told stories of himself being sexually abused as a child, and the shockingly high numbers, the statistics within that organization, even though they don't necessarily have a single charismatic leader, they may have had in Charles Taze Russell when the cult started.
Yes.
But now it's more about the governing body, isn't it? There's still a huge degree of or lack of accountability and the two witness rule. So they've done are doing a tremendous amount of damage, certainly to children.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think what you see in the Witnesses, which is over a century of history going back to Charles Taze Russell, who can be seen as a destructive cult leader. At that time, the group was called the Russellites. And then when Judge Rutherford succeeded Russell, he was a virtual dictator and would be the equivalent of David Miscavige, who succeeded L. Ron Hubbard and now runs Scientology. Yes. So I think it took a long time for power to devolve from one man leadership to the governing body, which is about a dozen or so old white men who run the organization, which has a very large non-white population. There are many Hispanic members. There are many African Americans, for example, that are part of Jehovah's Witnesses. For example, the family of Michael Jackson was involved for some time. So basically, the Witnesses evolved from that authoritarian one-man rule to a kind of government that is very authoritarian. And let's not forget that they discourage blood transfusion, which results in deaths every year. And in addition to the two witness rule, which basically stipulates if there are not two witnesses to your sexual abuse, then you cannot bring it to the elders and expect them to do something. So it's really just a gimmick, in my opinion, to suppress the reporting of sexual abuse. And the witnesses recently lost a huge lawsuit in the United States with a judgment of tens of millions of dollars against them. And I think there's more to come. I think that the Jehovah's Witnesses, much like the Catholic Church to some extent, have suppressed the information about sexual abuse of children.
Oh, absolutely. Well, this is one of the things we talked about with the two ex-Jehovah's Witnesses from Australia, the Royal Commission on Institutional Child Sexual Abuse. They investigated the Jehovah's Witness organization in Australia, and they've come up with shocking statistics. Something like out of 68,000 witnesses across the country, over 1,800 known cases of child sexual abuse, and over 1,000 abusers, none of which have come to the police's attention. Not a single one has been reported or caught because of, as you say, in large part because of the two witness rule. So this is a fascinating thing. Why is it, though, that there's such a pattern of sexual abuse within cults? Because this is something I remember reading about in Robert Lifton's article on cult formation. One of the markers of cults is economic and sexual exploitation of their members. Why is that such a prevalent thing within cults?
Well, it just goes to lack of accountability and transparency. When you have, let's say that we have a Christian fundamentalist church that's Southern Baptist or Assemblies of God or Church of the Nazarene, they may have very specific beliefs, and some of those beliefs may cause people to say, oh, they're very ethnocentric, they're very black and white in their thinking, but their governance is democratic. That is, members of the church vote for a board. Members of the board serve fixed terms. The convention, the Southern Baptist Convention, has delegates from churches across the United States. And then they elect their leadership. And that leadership serves fixed terms. And the finances of the denomination are transparent. Now, I'm not saying that the Southern Baptists don't have problems.
Oh,
because
yes,
they themselves have come out recently and talked about the evils of sexual abuse within the denomination. They have problems. But the more accountability that a government of an organization has to the membership, and the more financial transparency it exists, the more likely it is that there will be less abuse, because people are being watched. They're being held accountable for what they do. In these groups that have an ecclesiastical authority, whether it's the Roman Catholic Church or Jehovah's Witnesses, they have much less accountability and transparency, and therefore they can cover things up, get away with things, and so on.
Well, you mentioned Scientology. I mean, right now, nobody knows where David Miscavige's wife is, Shelley Miscavige. I mean, he's appeared at numerous Scientology conventions and events without his wife for the last 10 years, and nobody seems to be able to answer that question. So that right there has got to show you that they're not holding David Miscavige accountable. They're so afraid, so controlled. You talk about a complete lack of accountability just within one cult. So that's a striking example, isn't it?
Well, Clint, let me say, I know where Shelley Miscavige is.
You know where she is.
She's at a very kind of secluded, quiet, backwater installation of Scientology in California. She's living quietly there. I mean, David Miscavige apparently wanted to shelve her and get her out of the way, because you're right, she hasn't appeared publicly, but she is. The police have gone by and they've talked to her.
That's
and she's basically
said, yes,
a loyal Scientologist. She is in an enclave of Scientology that is kind of off the beaten path, but is in California. And it's a comfortable place. She's living apparently fairly comfortably there, quietly. And David Miscavige wants her to stay there, it appears. And she does not appear publicly, and that seems to be the way Mr. Miscavige wants it to be. And what's interesting about David Miscavige is that I think it could be argued that as bad as L. Ron Hubbard was, and he's been described as a psychopath and a madman, David Miscavige might just be worse. I mean, in the sense that he is more demanding and at times violent. I mean, there have been reports of him literally beating up executives of Scientology, just being very physically violent. And in addition to that, they have this place called The Hole in Hemet, California, at the Golden Era Studios facilities, which is outside of Los Angeles. And there are people that are being held there in a kind of rehabilitation project that Scientology has for people that displease David Miscavige. And the former president of Scientology, Heber Jensch, is in that facility, according to what I have heard. And it's not very good living conditions. Much worse than Shelley Miscavige.
We've been watching the Leah Remini Scientology The Aftermath series, and this is something they've talked about. Obviously, Mike Rinder was a very high-level Scientologist. He spent time in the hole whenever he did something that apparently displeased David Miscavige. And yet, this is what's so fascinating to me about the whole thing, and that is that he made the comment the other day in one of the shows we watch. People are being held against their will. You're talking about human rights violations. But even if the FBI had somehow stormed the compound and burst in the doors and said, okay, we're here to free everybody, you're being kept against your will, they would have stayed. So they're that controlled. How is it that cult leaders or cult groups can use these sort of mind control indoctrination techniques to where people can't see it, they won't see it, they won't get out? How is it that they're so powerfully controlled by these cult groups?
Well, I devoted two chapters of my book to Scientology. One, to explain briefly kind of its history and how it manipulates people. And a second chapter about how I participated and facilitated an intervention to get a man out of Scientology who had been a member for 27 years. So really what, you know, and I have been qualified, accepted, and testified as an expert in court about Scientology. And most recently, in Washington, D.C., I was qualified and accepted in a case, even though Scientology's chief counsel, lawyer Kendrick Moxon, was flown in to try and knock me out in the process of qualification. He failed to do so. And this was a case where a boy was involved, child custody, and this is not unusual. The Scientology parent did not want their child to associate with the father, who I believe was considered either a suppressive person, which is Scientology jargon for somebody they don't want you to have contact with, or a potential trouble source, PTS, which means someone who might be fraternizing with an SP, suppressive person. And that kind of labeling and that kind of manipulation is how they control their people. That is, they tell you who you can associate with and who you cannot associate with by labeling them SP, PTS. And then you go through training or auditing sessions and courses in which they embed their programming in your mind. And then in addition to that, they have a power structure, which includes core supervisors, auditors, who are the people that you are confessing to, and ethics officers who deal with enforcement and so on. And these layers in the Scientology machine reinforce the programming. And then you yourself become so involved in Scientology that you really lose touch with reality in the sense of objective reality in the outside world. Your social proof, that is what you see around you that demonstrates what is real and what is not real, is controlled by Scientology, especially if you're in the hole or you're a Sea Org member, which means you're a full-time staffer of Scientology and you live in Scientology housing. Everything you see, everything you read, your constant activity is within this bubble of Scientology, and you have no way to get accurate feedback outside of that bubble, particularly if you're in Sea Org or you're in the hole.
One of the hallmarks of cults is this mentality, like you say, this us versus them. We're the good people. They, whoever they are, the outsiders, they're the evil ones. And like you say, Scientology has their language for it. Suppressive people, people that you have to watch out for. How is it that groups are able to create this sort of us versus them mentality? Is that one of the hallmarks of being able to control people? There's that fear of the outside world, the fear of the other, and that you can't, you know, you can't associate with them. So you've got to keep your distance. And so is that how one of the ways that groups are able to keep their control over their followers?
Yes, I would say they inculcate and indoctrinate their people to have unreasonable fear about leaving the group, that there's no legitimate reason to leave, about disagreeing with leadership. They fear basically of annihilation. I mean, if, for example, you take somebody like Mike Rinder, who was at one time at very close to the top of the food chain in Scientology near Miscavige. He was in charge of all public relations and he was the official spokesperson for Scientology. And he ended up being beat up, according to his account, and thrown into the hole and basically living in substandard living conditions that most of us could barely imagine, let alone an executive in Scientology. But Rinder, who had family in Scientology and continues to have family in Scientology, has this fear of annihilation. And what I mean by that is Rinder feared they're going to declare me an SP if I leave. And then my family will be told to disconnect from me because that is consistent with what Scientology calls disconnection policy. So Rinder today, I'm sure, carries just enormous grief and a feeling of sorrow over the members of his family that he cannot easily, if at all, communicate with because he left. And once you leave, you're declared a suppressive person and very likely declared. Very few people manage to leave and not be declared. And then once that happens, you cease to exist. You know, it's what Robert J. Lifton wrote a seminal book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism. And in it, Lifton calls this the dispensing of existence. That is, if you leave the group and there's no legitimate reason to leave a destructive cult, if you leave, you're wrong, you're bad, you cease to exist. They cut you off. And if you have family, friends, and have grown up in a particular group, as many people have, it is really, really tough.
It's very difficult. And virtually every cult has that power they wield over their members, don't they? One of the guests that I had the other week said that in Jehovah's Witnesses, it's about being declared an apostate and then being shunned, which is exactly the same line that they take, where once you leave the organization, the religion, You're an apostate, you're shunned, and friends and family still in the system have nothing to do with you. So there's a huge social cost that must be paid, and that's going to stop people oftentimes from leaving the group. They're afraid it's too high of a cost to pay. And then, as you say, they don't deserve to exist anymore, whether it's metaphorical or in a real sense. As you say, Lifton commented, they're cast into outer darkness, aren't they? In a way, they're never going to come back. So it's a very controlling thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to say, in Jehovah's Witnesses, the unreasonable fear includes not only I'm going to be disfellowshipped and shunned and not have any connection with my family, and be a pariah. But in addition to that, Jehovah God is going to murder me. The end is coming, and Jehovah God will murder me. And I will cease to exist because I have turned my back on the one and only true organization. A lot of people get very confused with Jehovah's Witnesses. They think the reason that witnesses don't vote or don't join the military is because they are like Quakers and they're pacifists and they're nonviolent. That is not the reason. The reason is that according to Jehovah's Witnesses, any organization outside of their organization is under the influence of Satan. Therefore, if you register in a political party, you vote in an election, and you participate in the Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts, you're in a football league, you are under the influence of Satan because all organizations other than Jehovah's Witnesses are under the influence of Satan. And there is only one true organization that Jehovah God has mandated, according to Jehovah's Witnesses, and that's them. And so they can break up families, destroy marriages, alienate children from parents. I mean, it's a mess. And I have testified in court many times as an expert regarding Jehovah's Witnesses and what they do and how their practices, their behavior, negatively impacts families and children. One of the most ironic things about Jehovah's Witnesses, they have predicted the end of the world repeatedly. And yet at the same time that they were prophetically, supposedly, foreseeing this incredible destruction of the world as we know it, they were accumulating a massive real estate portfolio in New York City, which they have recently liquidated for over $1 billion and counting as they reconstitute their world headquarters in Warwick, New York, which is much cheaper real estate. So here's an organization that told its members, the end is near, the end is near. Meanwhile, they're making long-term investments in real estate, planning and developing and using witnesses to maintain and refurbish their real estate holdings. And, to me, it's a business. And what I see is a rather cynical use of power.
Well, as you say, the Scientology is the same thing, that people have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for all their auditing and all that, and then at the end of it, what do you get? They're making so much money, and they've turned around and invested it into real estate all over the world. They've built these ideal org buildings, and yeah, as you say, the Watchtower, if they believe their own theology, why are they investing in long-term real estate? They should be selling everything. Because that's what they told their followers to do. Well, this was a question I had for the XJWs. I said, what about this issue of cognitive dissonance? Because you, as a Jehovah's Witness, you were told repeatedly the world was going to end, Armageddon was going to come, 1975, then again in 2000, but it didn't happen. So what about this cognitive dissonance? This is an organization you were told Jehovah himself gave them the word of prophecy, and it's infallible, and yet it's wrong, clearly, because it didn't happen. So how can they live with this cognitive dissonance? I was thinking about what Lifton says. He talks about doctrine over person. You have this conflict between what you're experiencing in your own mind and what your dogma says you should experience, and they end up suppressing their own critical thinking faculties. So I'm curious to find out what you have to say about this whole issue of cognitive dissonance and how it relates to cults.
Well, cognitive dissonance theory is really relevant when you talk about cults that prophesy something or a leader says something will happen, it doesn't. And yet you see that most of the people still stay anyway. So the dissonance is the leader said the world was going to end. The world did not end on that date. The leader then gave a new spin. That's the key. The leader then, Jehovah's Witnesses then said, wait a minute, the end is fluid. We can't give you an exact date. Hang in there. And then the next step of cognitive dissonance is that you have a group that provides a false social proof. I mean, you basically have a bunch of people accepting the spin of the leader, whatever it is, and then reinforcing that spin and saying everything's just fine. And as long as the individual is embedded in that false social proof, in that construct, in that bubble, that echo chamber, where everyone is saying, oh, yeah, that's a perfectly reasonable explanation. The world didn't end because God decided to give us more time because of all of our prayers and our leaders' prayers, and so we've been given an extension. And the end is going to be near, but it's not as near as we once thought, and everything is fine, and we're going to stay. And that's how Jehovah's Witnesses have managed their people for decade after decade after decade. Going all the way back to Russell and Rutherford.
Yeah, they said the world was going to end in 1914.
That's the way many groups operate.
And I remember reading an article about, I can't remember the name of the specific cult, but it was a sci-fi alien type cult in the 1970s, I think it was, that predicted that the saucer people were going to come and rescue only those followers, and they were going to be taken away. But within the group, there was some sociologists, and I think this is where that cognitive dissonance theory sort of was maybe formulated or at least stated. Of course, the world didn't end. The saucer people didn't come. Well, they're testing us. They've given us an extension, as you say. They just wanted to see if we were really serious about, you know, we were all gathered, we were ready to go, but it didn't happen. And then they said, well, the sociologists, what people are looking for is cognitive consonance. They're seeking for a way to quell those feelings of discomfort that they're feeling, because obviously the saucer people didn't come, the world didn't end, and yet the group said that it was going to. They've got to have some cognitive consonance. So there's always got to be an answer, isn't there, somehow in these groups?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the key is maintaining the cohesiveness of the group, maintaining what Lifton would call milieu control, control of the environment, control of communication, information. And within that bubble, whatever the leader says is right, and whatever the leader says is wrong. And in these authoritarian groups, the only way you can vote is with your feet. You know, you just say, well, I want to leave because I'm disappointed. And many witnesses have left. In fact, the attrition rate of Jehovah's Witnesses is quite high. And I suspect there are probably more ex-members of Scientology than current members. But they keep pulling new people in, particularly the Witnesses, who are a very large organization. Though Scientology seems to be dwindling, I suspect they may have less than 50,000 members worldwide, though they claim to have millions, and they certainly have a lot of money. I mean, they have billions of dollars in cash and assets. But do they really have the kind of growth potential that they once would talk about during the 70s and the 80s? I just don't see it. I think Scientology is basically kind of melting, and that David Miscavige is largely responsible for that meltdown.
It seems like a common factor, isn't it, is the internet. This is something that one of the ex-Jehovah's Witnesses mentioned. She said people now have access to online information about the cult that they're a part of, and this has done a tremendous amount of damage, or we would say good, perhaps, from our point of view, trying to get people out of these groups or avoid people getting into them, is that they can go online and read about it, whereas before, the information control, they were able to stop members from hearing any negative press. And, of course, that's one of the hallmarks of cults, isn't it, is information control. If they can control the flow of information to the members, then they've got the upper hand, don't they? But now, as she said, us apostates, we've got the upper hand now because we've got the internet. We can post stuff out there and people can actually read about it and get the truth on what the organization is doing.
Well, you know, Clint, that there's two edges to that sword. And I speak as someone who launched a database in 1996, which is probably the largest database of its kind on the web. You can find it at culteducation.com, and it includes cultnews.net, and, of course, there's the Cult Education Institute, which is a 501c3 educational nonprofit in the United States. Maintains a Facebook page, a Twitter account, and probably at least 1,000 people a day use the database. I mean, it's very widely used, and it's been constantly expanded. But despite that, on the flip side, these groups called destructive cults, they have their own web presence as well. And the increasing phenomenon of the web and social media is that these groups are now able to recruit through Facebook, recruit particularly through YouTube. A lot of them have just an enormous amount of indoctrinational videos. For example, Israelites United in Christ, which is a black supremacist group led by a guy by the name of Nathaniel Ray in New York. They have a global presence through their YouTube account. They're expanding rapidly across the United States, opening up what they call new camps. And what I see as a phenomenon is that the web and social media is used, if you will, like a funnel to feed people into these groups, and that there are even some groups that exist completely on the web without people actually meeting face-to-face. They Skype, they Google Gaggle, they watch YouTube, they pay the group through PayPal. And there are cult leaders that I've dealt with and written about. You know, for example, there's a woman who claims to have mystical powers and channel cosmic beings. Her name is Sherry Daniel, and she's in the Pacific Northwestern part of the United States. But she, again, reaches out through the web, and people pay her thousands and thousands of dollars for her so-called mystical insights and cosmic knowledge. So what we're seeing now is the web works two ways. One, it can work to help you. It can work to inoculate you through access to information, access to knowledge, and databases with information about various groups like Scientology and Jehovah's Witnesses and so on. But there are also people that are using it to recruit, and they're using it quite effectively.
We're not picking on just Scientology, but they've used the web to attack suppressive people, anyone that they've labeled an enemy, haven't they? So there's all kinds of hate web pages out there that are run by Scientology specifically to attack people like Mike Rinder, Leah Remini, anyone who speaks out against the Church of Scientology. So yeah, you're right. It's a double-edged sword, isn't it? There's a lot of information, but it's hard to know who's behind it, who's actually putting it forth.
Well, I think that's a good point, is who runs the web page.
Exactly.
For example, Scientology has an attack page on me. They've had it up for years. They've had me on their suppressive persons list for decades. You know, I mean, they flew Kendrick Moxon in just recently to, you know, grill me and try to keep me from being qualified as an expert in a court case. So that's just what Scientology does. And when you see an attack page, you have to kind of figure out, well, what is this organization? Because they'll use a front organizational name. Yeah. And then you keep drilling, and eventually you hit pay dirt. And you find, oh, this is Scientology. And I give enormous credit to Mike Rinder and Leah Remini to come out and take the hits that they've taken and take Scientology on. In particular, Mike Rinder, for me, is a heroic figure, because he's paid just a very high price to be able to speak out. He's lost his family. He's gone through hell. And I know, I've been through hell with Scientology, too. I mean, they sued me for and had me in court tied up in litigation for about 6 years. And until I bumped into a cult leader by the name of Keith Raniere, who headed a group called Nexium, which has now become a notorious cult in the United States. Raniere sued me for 14 years. 14 years before a federal court said it's over, it's dismissed.
That's enough. Huh?
That's part of what you pay, the price you pay, whether you're Mike Rinder, Leah Remini, or myself. If you want to take on some of these groups, they can be very ugly.
I've been sued
five times by different groups. The worst actually was not Scientology. The worst was Nexium, led by Keith Raniere, who was bankrolled by Seagram's liquor heiresses and who sued me for 14 years.
I cannot believe that, 14 years. I've heard a little bit about Nexium. They're in a lot of trouble, aren't they, right now, though? They've got a lot of lawsuits of their own, at least Raniere does, for abusing members and branding them and all kinds of bizarre practices. Isn't he in some sort of lawsuit right now?
Well, it's worse than that. I mean, he's in jail. He'll be in jail a year in April for racketeering and sex trafficking. And he's been denied bail for the third time recently. Clara Bronfman, the Seagram's heiress, who helped bankroll him, and bankrolled in particular the litigation against me, which cost millions of dollars to perpetuate for 14 years, she is free now on $100 million bail and wearing an electronic monitoring ankle bracelet, I think. The actress Allison Mack, who is well known for her role in the television series Smallville, is also under house arrest with electronic monitoring. And there are, I think, two or three others, including Nancy Salzman and her daughter, Lauren Salzman, who are also free on bail. The trial is coming up probably in April. And the judge seems to think that Raniere is going to be convicted and that he's a flight risk. And that's why he's denied him bail three times. But the Bronfmans, according to one report, funneled, that is Claire Bronfman and her sister Sarah Bronfman, heirs to the Seagram's liquor fortune, they probably gave Raniere about $100 million. those two sisters. And then there were other rich people and celebrities that continued to give Ranieri money. And he developed a kind of sex cult where there were women who were his kind of like his harem. And then in addition to that, he actually physically branded women with his initials with a cauterizing iron. He didn't do it personally. He had a doctor that was a member of the group do it for him, though I think he watched by video. Just an incredibly brutal man who I met face to face on more than one occasion. And in my opinion, he just doesn't have a conscience.
Complete
about
sociopath.
The things that he has done.
Well, that's one of the things, isn't it, that's so striking about so many cults is the increasingly inappropriate levels of behavior that the cult leader will demand and receive by his followers. You know, whether it's David Miscavige physically beating multiple executives and there's no accountability, or Ranieri having women branded with his initials in their inner thigh, and all kinds of, or David Koresh having multiple children, brides, sexually abusing little girls, and on and on and on. And yet they seem to get away with all of it. It's just, I have a hard time wrapping my head around getting to that level of control and evil and, you know, manipulation of others. Sexual, economic. I think this is why people can't understand how people can allow themselves to be in those situations and be that controlled and that brainwashed.
Well, look, I have been called a cult deprogrammer. I've done more than 500 interventions around the world. Five of the people that I was hired to deprogram were medical doctors. One was an orthopedic surgeon. Another was an anesthesiologist. On one occasion, I also did an intervention to help a clinical psychologist get out of a cult-like situation. So I've encountered people who are not just smart, they're brilliant.
Yeah, highly
educated.
And
they have been, as has been said, brainwashed or under undue influence through coercive persuasion techniques. And I think the key, the most salient single feature of this type of control is you're plugged in. And the key to getting out is unplugging from the group, giving yourself a break to be in an environment with other ideas, other people giving you alternate feedback so that you can then reflect and examine what's going on. But as long as you're plugged in, and the group is charging its program in your head, and they surround you and control your milieu, your environment, it's very hard to think outside of the box. It's very difficult. I mean, look at North Korea.
Exactly.
That's an example of a country that is controlled by what can be seen as a political cult.
Yeah, the whole country's
for
a cult.
For three generations. And the people are in love with the leader, and they feel the leader is everything to them, is an object of worship. And the key to his control over North Korea is his control of the environment, his control of information, his control of communication. And when North Koreans are unplugged, that is, they have an opportunity to think outside of the box, which is very difficult because of their controlled environment. They can think maybe the leader's wrong. But in order to do that, you have to unplug yourself from the group for a break.
And it's very difficult, as you say. I read one article about a Korean, he defected from North Korea, and they asked him, what made you sort of wake up and see it? And he said, because I was tasked, he was in the Korean army, North Korean army, and he was tasked with chasing down soldiers who had gone AWOL. And that required him to travel all over the country during the time when they were having a tremendous famine. And he saw the incredibly bad conditions all over the country, and he thought to himself, now wait a minute, we've always been told by our leaders, we're one of the most wealthy, most a satisfied country of all the countries in the world. We have the best living conditions, and yet I'm seeing it all over the country. It's terrible. People are starving and dying, and that's what sort of broke him down in that cognitive dissonance, and he escaped. He ended up fleeing to China, and now he warns people about the very things you're talking about. So I'm interested to find out, too, people who've left cults, what about this issue of reconstructing people's identities? After you've left the cult behind, how do you do that? What are ways that you would recommend in terms of helpful techniques for people who are deprogramming and reconstructing?
Well, I think the most important single thing is education. That is, you need to educate yourself about what happened. I've met people who leave one cult and they join another cult. I've called them cult hoppers. They hop about from one leader to the next. Why? Because they haven't taken a break and educated themselves and sorted things out. For example, what is coercive persuasion? How does it work? What is thought reform? How does it work? How does control of the environment play a part? How does the cult of confession, you know, this kind of loaded language of labeling people, how do these various factors work to imprison a person psychologically and emotionally? How does that all work? And what is there about the group that you don't know that you should know in order to sort through your experience? So when I wrote the book, Cults Inside Out, I tried to basically, from chapter one through the end of the book, take the reader on a journey. First, what is the modern history of cults, beginning with Charles Manson through to when the book was published, which was very late 2014? And then what is a destructive cult? What is an objective definition? And I used the core three characteristics that Lifton identified in his paper, Cult Formation, that was published at Harvard when he taught there. And then moving on, what is coercive persuasion or cult brainwashing? How does it really work? What is the synthesis of techniques that groups called cults use to trick and trap people for long periods of time in their organization? And it kind of answers the question, why do people stay so long? Because we know that not everyone that is targeted by a cult group will succumb to its techniques of coercive persuasion. But what we do know is that certain people will succumb, typically people who are going through a difficult time in their life, or there's a person they care about or trust that pulls them into the group. And then it's the same tricks that trap them and keep them in for so long. And like the man that I got out of Scientology, who had been trapped, in my opinion, in Scientology for 27 years. And it took a family intervention to get him out. So I think if people unwind the programming and stop and look at it all and understand the history of destructive cults, how they operate, and then also hear the recovery stories of people who have made it through to the other side and how they themselves have managed their recovery, I think that's the process of recovery that makes sense. And that is an educational process of awareness and understanding so that you can say to yourself, hey, I get it, and no other leader or group is going to run this game on me, because I know their tricks and I know how they trap people because I've done the research and I've done the due diligence and reading to understand what happened to me, and it's not going to happen again.
I think you're absolutely right. This whole issue of education, educating yourself, because as I'm going back to my comment about watching those series of shows on the Twisted Faith Week, what struck me was that, as I said before, the parallels between my own experience. Now, I never thought that evangelical Christianity could be cult-like. I could see some things, but when I started going, as you say, going and reading articles like Lifton, and I've read a tremendous amount of articles on your website, which I was going to say, thank you for putting that together, because it's been very helpful to me as a resource, reading books and things. I've started to see how I was controlled, how I was part of the system. I mean, I was in education, I was a pastor, I taught, I did a PhD in theology, religious studies, I taught for 8 years. I mean, I was in the system, and I never thought that I was part of a cult or a cult-like organization, and yet now part of my reconstruction is, as you say, seeing how I was manipulated, how I was controlled, and the religious trauma that I've had to deal with. just as an ex-evangelical. So I think that's a very good point. I was going to ask you, too, would you recommend trying to get someone out of a cult? Let's say you've got a friend or family member who's still in the cult. Maybe you've gotten out. What would you say to that person who's got people still in the system? Would you say it's a good idea to try to get them out?
Well, yes, it's a good idea to try to get them out, but you have to have a plan. You can't just go at it willy-nilly and say, oh, you're in a cult, you need to get out. That's not going to be an effective strategy. I think, again, you have to educate yourself. And in my book, I have a chapter on assessment, a chapter on preparation for an intervention, a chapter on intervention. And I explain in great detail how an intervention is done. And I did that because there's a dwindling number of intervention specialists, or what was once called culty programmers, left. And so I wanted to basically explain how did we do it and how is it done. And I think it's a process of strategy, and it's based on maintaining communication and maintaining access so that you can eventually accomplish something. For example, you want to keep in touch with that person who's in a destructive cult. You want to tell them, hey, I love you. I care about you. You're my friend. You're my family member. And I want you to stay in touch with me. And as much as possible, you want to do that. And you have to keep in mind that whatever you say to that person may be then retold, recited to somebody in the group who is basically watching over them, coaching them, and handling them. In Scientology, it would be an auditor who they go to for counseling, spiritual counseling auditing sessions, and they talk about everything and anything in their life. So when you talk to somebody who you think is in a destructive cult, you have to edit yourself and filter yourself. You can't just say anything, because that may be repeated back to someone in the cult, and that may then come back to haunt you, in the sense that the group will then tell the person, well, don't talk to that friend or family member anymore. So you want to preserve your communication. You want to preserve your access. Then you want to strategize whatever intervention effort you might do, and you want to get the timing right. You want to have the right mix of people there for the intervention. And then you may find the right time when you think it is opportune and meaningful to do that intervention. Because I would say the longer a person is in a destructive cult, the harder it is to get them out. And therefore, sooner is usually better than later. And depending upon how entangled they are in the group, that is, do they have a relationship with someone in the group? Are they married to someone in the group? Do they rely on the group for their livelihood? To what extent are they entangled and enmeshed? And that, again, points up the difficulty of a potential intervention.
Well, and of course, this is all assuming that you can actually physically contact the person that you're trying to get out. I mean, what about certain cults that where you've got friends or family members in the cult and you don't know where they are? We've been watching that series, Escaping Polygamy, the FLDS, Warren Jeffs. And if they find out that you're trying to contact someone within the cult, they will just disappear them. They'll move them five states away. You don't know where they are. You don't know what they're doing. You've literally lost them. I don't know how people deal with that if they've got sisters, brothers, father, mothers, whoever, they're still in a cult. What if they maybe were responsible for bringing them into the cult? How do they deal with that grief and the loss and the anger? Like you said, Mike Rinder, he's got children that were born into Scientology that he cannot talk to, period. How do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, Clint, you pointed out something that is true. Now, it's a minority of people that I would say are involved in destructive cults that are completely cut off from their family and friends. Usually there is some level of communication. But there are groups that have compounds that absolutely forbid communication. I've dealt with that many times. There are nomadic, wandering cults There was a group called the Brethren, or also known as the Garbage Eaters, because they would literally eat from dumpsters behind McDonald's or wherever. And they followed a leader who claimed to be a prophet, and they had no particular place that they actually lived. And so there are groups that are a transient like that, and that the families don't know where their loved ones are. And then there are these groups that have enforced silence, where there is no communication. And so that's a problem. But in, I would say, at least 80% of the calls that I get are from families that do know where their loved one is, have some level of communication, but need to be coached on what to say and what not to say. And I have a chapter in my book titled Coping Strategies, where I try to help families see what they're saying and how the tone of their conversation can affect their future communication, and that they need to be very careful. Now, with people like Mike Rinder and others that have raised families in groups called cults like Scientology, it can be devastating to realize I brought a child into this group, and they're only in this group because I brought them in. And the explanation for how you can, you know, deal with that is and I'm sure Mike Rinder probably has come to this conclusion, that when he raised his family in Scientology, he felt, I think, that Scientology was a wonderful thing, and that this was a great thing that he was sharing with his family, and this was a wonderful life for his children. That was the belief that he had when he was an active Scientologist. He certainly wasn't thinking, I want to do my family harm. He wanted what he thought was best for them at that time. And there are groups like Children of God, now known as the Family International, which mandated, the leader Moses David Berg mandated, that children have sex as young as 4 years old. And so children were systematically, as a matter of doctrinal practice, sexually abused in the Children of God. And there were thousands of them. And one of them, Ricky Rodriguez, which was widely reported, would later murder a woman who had sexually abused him as a child, and then he killed himself.
Yes, I remember hearing
that story. And many of these children who have left Children of God, a lot of them have called me and talked to me about what you just said, which is that they love their parents, but they hate their parents. They love them because I love my dad, I love my mom. But how did they do this to me? How did they do this to our family? I was sexually abused, many of these kids will tell me, because my parents were in this group, the Children of God, and they, as a matter of doctrine, encouraged and allowed for me to be sexually abused. And how do they reconcile that, particularly if the parent has left the group, which many have, and then the family kind of tries to get along? This is what happened to the family of Joaquin Phoenix and River Phoenix, the actor,
yes,
who died at the age of 26 from a drug overdose, which is not an uncommon story of Children of God, because many of the kids that left suffered emotionally and psychologically enormously, and found it very difficult to deal with their pain, and they would use drugs and alcohol to self-medicate. And the Phoenix family was in the Children of God, and then they left, and I don't know what turmoil existed, but River Phoenix once in an interview said that he lost his virginity at the age of 4.
Wow, that's shocking. But not in the context of the cult, unfortunately. Well, do you make a distinction between, let's say, first and second generation cult members? Because it seems like in the reading I've been doing, the tactics or the techniques of dealing with an ex-cult member, someone who came into it as an adult, let's say, and then left, is going to have a different experience, obviously, than a child who was born into a cult, a second generation or third generation cultist. How you deal with that person having come out of the cult? Do you see a big distinction and difference between those kind of people?
Absolutely. River Phoenix, when he lost his virginity at the age of 4, according to this one interview that he did, that was when he was in the cult. And yeah, he did not know that there was another way to live. And so that's something that you have to understand. I mean, this really came out very intensely when the Texas Child Protective Services raided the Yearning for Zion Ranch in El Dorado, Texas, which was this huge compound constructed by FLDS leader Warren Jeffs to house his elite and to sexually abuse children in these bizarre rituals in their so-called temple. And finally, the authorities raided the place. There were 400 children removed from the Yearning for Zion Ranch. Eventually, though, they gave the kids back to the organization because these kids had nothing outside of the FLDS. All their family, their friends, their whole way of life was the FLDS. And for them to be taken out of that environment, they felt like they were aliens landing in a spaceship on another planet. That's how out of sync they were with the outside world, which they had never experienced. They were so embedded within this group. And there are many groups like this. And so the issues of young people or adults who have grown up their entire life in a group called a destructive cult, they have different issues because there is no foundation. I mean, it isn't like an adult who joined the group, they were in for a few years and they left. They have a different story.
You were talking about the children who had left, were taken out of the FLDS compound and then were put back in. They absolutely have no context, do they? Because that was their whole worldview, wasn't it? That's a whole experience.
Right. And actually, I realize this in my own work professionally because I've worked with many children that have left destructive cults. In one case that I handled, there were 21 children removed from a group in Ohio, which is in the Midwestern part of the United States. And this group, the mother of nine of the children was murdered when she tried to leave the group. And the court then awarded her children, they had awarded custody to her, and then her husband killed her, and he remained loyal to the group. He was imprisoned, and then the nine children came under the authority of Children's Services. And then another 12 children were removed by Children's Services. And I worked with a total of 21 children from that group. And these kids knew nothing but the group. You have to realize when there is a group where the children are homeschooled, they don't go to public school, they don't associate with children from the outside, they only have one, again, social proof. That is one way to test reality, and that is within their group. And the group is constantly reinforcing its worldview, its version of reality, which we see as bizarre and even crazy, but to the people in the bubble, in the echo chamber, it is the only reality they know. And if that has been the only reality they've known since they were born, it is very, very difficult to make that transition. But many of them do. I've talked to many young adults, 18 or older, that chose to leave destructive cults. For example, there's a group called the 12 Tribes, which is led by a so-called prophet, and this group has various compounds or communities in different locations in the United States and in Europe and in South America. And there are a number of kids who have left this group despite all of the indoctrination, despite the fact that they were born in the group, that they were homeschooled in the group, that their family is still in the group. They decided to leave. And it's been difficult for them, but they have made the transition. I've talked to a number of kids that grew up in 12 tribes and left. And I've talked to a number of adults who that is their history. They grew up in a destructive cult. They knew nothing else, but they managed to get out. It's tough. It's tougher for them than probably anyone. But I think there are many success stories, and many of these young people have written books about their experiences and their journeys. And I think for those people who are now grappling with this whole issue and have left a group or thinking of leaving a group, getting a hold of that kind of material, the books written by former members, the accounts, the narratives, that really is a way of lighting your path out and helping you to understand that what you're feeling and what you're dealing with is the same as what other people have dealt with. And if they overcame it, you can too.
Exactly. It's very empowering to have your experiences validated, isn't it? When you read about something or you hear someone's story, you think, my God, I'm not the only one. There are other people, thousands, maybe millions of people across the world who have had similar experiences, and I'm not crazy. I'm not alone. This is hugely empowering. Well, I don't want to keep you too long. I'm aware we've kind of gone a while. I've really enjoyed having this conversation. I wish we could go on longer. But if people do want to get a hold of you, if they've got questions or they want to talk to you, what's the best way to do that as far as social media?
Well, they can easily contact me by going to the Cult Education Institute web presence, which is culteducation.com. That is the main portal. The Cult Education Institute has a message board, public message board. They can easily email me or call me. Also, there's a YouTube channel for Cult Education Institute with educational videos. And I would encourage people to read the book Cults Inside Out, because I think what I did as best as I could was I wove together the narratives of many, many people that had left destructive cults. And what I think I was able to do in the book was show the common thread that pulls through all of these groups. And I think that's also very liberating to be able to say, okay, my group is saying that it's a perfectly nice group, that we're all about God, or we're all about empowerment or some uplifting philosophy. But yet when I read the narrative of people that were in the Manson family, or people that followed David Koresh or Jim Jones or other groups called cults, it sounds like and looks like my group.
Exactly.
How could that possibly be?
How can that be?
How could that be? You know, and I think that's very empowering, is to be able to say, look, if it quacks like a duck and it walks like a duck, it just might be a duck. If my group matches up with the narratives that I'm reading, the firsthand accounts of other people that were in destructive cults, and if what they experienced is very similar to what I have experienced, then what I have experienced is very likely a destructive cult.
You're absolutely right. There's so many common threads. I remember hearing a woman on BBC Radio a few months ago, and she was talking about growing up in Iran after the revolution, and it became basically a religious fundamental state. And yet, as she was describing her experiences, I thought a lot of these things are true of Jewish fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism, Hindu fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism. You strip away the sort of distinctive dogmas about all those religions, and at their core, as you say, there's a common set of threads in these fundamentalist, sort of totalist groups. And I think, how can this be? Whether they're Jewish, Christian, Hindu, Muslim, why are they so common? So there's got to be, as you say, it's very empowering to start to see these threads, isn't it?
Clint, I would say that there are two kind of hubs of organizing what goes on in certain extreme fundamentalist groups. And that is, they like what they control and they don't like what they don't control. And that becomes an organizing principle. And so whatever we don't control is bad, what we do control is good, and it's all about power and control. And then when you can't seem to quite get your head around why a group is doing what they're doing, I think an organizing principle can be that what we do, what we say, and how we behave is for the recruitment and retention of members. So when you have those two axioms, we like what we control, we don't like what we don't control, and what we do or say has to do with the recruitment and retention of members, and this is all about our power base and our control, and authoritarian control, then you begin to see that regardless of whether the group claims to be Islamic, Christian, Buddhist, Jewish, whatever, that if you see that the group's core organizing principles are what I just enunciated, then you're really seeing the same thing with a different mask. Or as I used to kid around, I used to say, it's the same cow and it still moves. You know, I mean, it's just a different color of cow, a different bred cow, but it's still a cow.
Still a cow. Well, and I think going back to that fundamentalist idea, I heard someone say today on a podcast that the thing about religious ideology and fundamentalist ideology that's so appealing to so many people is that it gives you a whole set of prepackaged answers. You don't have to think. They've got all the answers. As you say, it's a totalist group. We've got everything under control. I mean, coming from my context in Christian fundamentalism, there was that sense of certitude. I know I'm going to heaven. I've got the Bible. The Bible's inspired. It's inerrant. We know how to interpret the Bible correctly. We've got all the answers. And there's a tremendous sense of security and certitude. And then when you start having that cognitive dissonance, that's when you start running into trouble, I think. So I hope, hopefully people can resonate, like you say, whatever group or if they've come out of a controlling cult, these threads exist, and it's very empowering to try to figure out what those commonalities are.
I don't know if you've ever read the book Holy Terror by Flo Conway and Jim Siegelman.
No, I
haven't. Have you read that book?
Not yet, but it's going to be on the list.
It was a book that came out in the early 80s, and Conway and Siegelman, who are experts in communication, they wrote a book that was very popular called Snapping. And that book came out in 1978, which was the year of the Jonestown Massacre, where almost 1,000 people died in a cult compound in English Guyana in South America under the leadership of Jim Jones, who at one time was a megachurch power pastor in the San Francisco Bay Area, but ended up with his diehard devotees in the jungles of Guyana. And Conway and Siegelman wrote this book, Snapping, in 1978 about the cult phenomenon. And then they came out with a new edition several years ago. But they also wrote another book that I think is key in understanding fundamentalism to some extent. That is, how it can be destructive. It isn't always destructive, but it can be. And I think Conway and Siegelman identified some of the core characteristics of destructive fundamentalism. And so they wrote this book called Holy Terror, which came out in the 80s. And they talk a lot about emotional control. And they talk about how people would suppress doubts by labeling them as satanic or demonic and say, well, you know, Satan is a doubt bringer. The devil's making me think that or feel that. And that would be a way that a Christian fundamentalist in the book Holy Terror, as described, would suppress their questioning of the leadership and the power structure that they were under. And it would explain why that was their means, or if you will, of a kind of cognitive dissonance. That is, when they doubted the leadership, And they started to have a kind of crisis internally regarding their faith, regarding their allegiance to their group. They were schooled and they were influenced to think, that isn't me thinking critically or intuitively. That's Satan attacking my mind. That's Satan using my emotions to attack me and bring me down to hell. And so I need to ignore my inner thoughts. I need to ignore my intuitive feelings and dismiss them under the label of that's satanic, that's demonic. And then whatever I think or feel that is consistent with the group, that is heavenly, that is godly, that is good. And then also, of course, and you've probably heard this, that if I question authority in the group, I'm in rebellion against God.
Exactly. Yep.
And there's this casting of the person as being rebellious against God, or a woman being possessed of a Jezebel spirit.
Oh yes, the Jezebel spirit.
If she questions authority. So Conway and Siegelman were really the first, I think, to examine the emotional control within Christian fundamentalism in the United States and how it could be used in a destructive manner. And I think anybody who's navigating out of those waters would find the book Holy Terror very interesting. And, of course, used books are sold on Amazon, so we can now get a hold of books like Holy Terror, even when they're out of print.
Yeah, for very cheap amounts of money. Well, I went through, in one of the podcasts I did back in January, I used Stephen Hassan's BITE model, and I basically correlated those four elements of his model of how cults control people to the world of evangelicalism that I was familiar with. So a lot of the things you just mentioned, I talked about in the podcast, especially like this issue of Christianese, which is nothing more than loaded language, just reducing complex things down to real simple, pithy phrases. God's in control. Everything's under the hand of God. Any kind of Christianese, that's a way to shut down that cognitive dissonance, isn't it? As you say, or say, well, it's the devil's making me do this. Satan's tempting me. So there's a lot of techniques and tricks that churches use that go right into the world of cults. So you're absolutely right. We have to be aware of these things and how we were manipulated, or especially if you've come out of a group like I did, or a cult, which I consider in many ways, which is what I came out of. Well, I don't want to keep you too long. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with everybody, Rick.
All right, Clint.
Yeah. We've got your ways to get a hold of you. It sounds like you've got some fantastic resources. Definitely pick up your book, Cults Inside Out. It sounds like a fantastic resource for people who are trying to get their heads around all this stuff, or maybe reprogramming or reconstructing. So thank you very much, Rick, for being a guest on Mindshift Podcast. I really appreciate you taking your time.
Well, thanks for having me on. And no matter how difficult it is possible to get to the other side. And I hope anybody listening can understand that and know that it's painful, but you can make it.
You know, I'm really glad that Rick actually mentioned that concept of psychological and emotional imprisonment. This is something that I discuss in my episode that I did that's right now. It's sitting on Patreon, but I think it'll come out as a podcast at some point here, maybe in a couple of weeks. But when I dealt with the psychology of conversion based on the work of Robert J. Lifton's book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, and it struck me that as I was going through the chapter where Lifton actually lays out sort of the psychological steps of thought reform and how it's actually done, that these were my lived experiences. And I said in that podcast that essentially people going into cults or fundamentalist evangelical churches, groups with undue influence, they are in effect walking into a psychological prison. They don't, of course, realize they're doing it. They think they're getting freedom from all their life's problems, and they're getting an eternal reward by going to heaven or whatever it is the group is offering or selling, salvation or help or whatever it may be. They might be offering enlightenment, or in the case of Scientology, they're offering to help you go clear. Whatever it is that group is selling, the end result is that the person is actually placing him or herself in this psychological and emotional prison. And in the case of some cults, you are literally physically going to be imprisoned. If you're a Scientologist, you might end up in the hole if you say something that will offend David Miscavige, even if you're a Scientology executive. And in some cases, there are actual compounds where people are literally imprisoned and they cannot leave. So we're talking about some very serious stuff here, and I'm fascinated to find out how it works. And of course, what's my interest in the whole thing? Well, I would say that it has certainly helped me a lot. It's helped me tremendously to go back, as Rick said, and sort of educate myself to find out how I was controlled, how I was manipulated, and all the processes that I've gone through and am going through in my reconstruction process. And hopefully that is maybe describing you. Maybe this has helped you to kind of work your way through some of the thought control, some of the thought reform manipulation maybe you experienced if you were a part of a controlling group or a cult or a church. Any group with undue influence, you're going to have to work out what it means to reconstruct yourself. And I thought it was interesting. I wanted to leave you with one last quote from Robert Lifton's book, there's a really good description, and I think it fits people who are leaving groups, leaving cults, who are trying to reconstruct. It's very disorienting, and I understand that. It's very troubling. And he says that, quote, immediately following release, all prisoners, and he was talking about prisoners that came out of Chinese communism and who had been brainwashed while they were there, but we could liken it to my example and what Rick said about psychological imprisonment too, and then having that release and being disoriented. And he says that all the prisoners experienced profound struggles about their integrity, their ability to trust, and their search for wholeness. None escaped the personal crisis of this transitional period any more than he could avoid involvement in the other steps. But each man's crisis was his own. And I've said this many times, that deconstruction looks different for everybody, and therefore reconstruction must also look different for every person. Each person's struggle is his or her own, and that's what Robert Lifton says. And I'm hoping, again, that this episode has helped you. Remember, I think in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be coming up with an interview with Dassey Ehrlich from Melbourne, Australia, as well as hopefully next month, an interview with Dr. Stephen Hassan. I've got some other good stuff in the pipeline, so stay tuned as we continue to explore the world of the cults. So thanks again to my guest, Rick Ross, for being a fantastic contributor to Mindshift Podcast, and I will see you in 2 weeks. Yes.